Disclaimer. The views and opinions you hear expressed by the participants in this show are not the views of AnimeNewsNetwork.com. Hope you enjoy the show. Everybody, welcome to AnCast. I'm Zach Barchi, joined today very special guest. I've known this guy for a long time, long time industry veteran, been around forever in this industry, had a 13-year run at Funimation as the director of marketing and strategy. Very happy to have this guy on the show. It's Lance Heiskell. Lance, thanks for coming by.
Hi, Zach. Hello, everybody.
We used to have you on this show every now and then with another guy who doesn't work at Funimation anymore, Adam Sheehan, back in the day. That was 10 years ago or so, something like that.
It's kind of weird that AnCast has been around this long. It's like, oh, wow. It has been.
It's 10 years old this August. just a little later this year, it'll officially turn old enough to be in fifth grade or something like that. So I wanted to have you on to talk about your like incredibly illustrious and long career during the fabled bubble era of anime in the United States, and it continued long into mostly into the present day. But I really, let's start at the beginning. You had this really long career at Funimation. So how did that? Let's start with the personal stuff at the very beginning. How did you get into anime? Like, what kind of a fan were you back then?
It was Robotech syndication.
Okay.
Growing up in the 80s. Mm-hmm. And then it was, buying the art book. And then that was it for a while until college, until my sister got into looking at Animerica. And then she would come over and have VHSs from Hastings of Oh My Goddess and Tenchi and Lotus War. And so that was my curiosity. And then she had, she was also one of the first moderators on Mega Tokyo. And
yeah.
So I know them, still know them. And so then she got these tapes called fan subs and watch stuff. And, that was college. That was, around the late 90s. And then I went to grad school in Dallas.
Right.
And then Netflix, they had Gundam Wing and Votoms as the only series that this is when you still had to mail things to San Mateo.
Right. Yeah.
Way back when. And then I would sometimes, my sister was more into going to the anime con. She drove to like Chicago and she drove to Baltimore from Dallas. Mm-hmm. And then that's how I got the bug. And then I went to Anime Fest 2002. And then I saw that Funimation was licensing anime. So that was curious. And, that's how I got into anime. How to get into the anime Funimation wise was that Anime Fest was, I saw that and, I worked at a Richards Group in an interactive agency, and that was after the bust of the dot-com bust. And
oh, right.
I kind of wanted something different. I didn't really want to work at an agency. I kind of want to work for a company. Mm-hmm. And then I'm like, Funimation is in Fort Worth? And they, just released Fruits Basket Volume 1. And so I went to the convention back the next day, got a Fruits Basket clear file. I wrote a cover letter and a resume. I put that in a huge 11x17 envelope, certified mail, so it wouldn't get lost. I just had it to go to marketing. And then in 3 weeks, I got interviewed and hired.
So they had released the first volume of Fruits Basket, which was at the time considered kind of a risk for a company like Funimation. That was like,
Yeah. It
was weird for them to be doing that because they were the Dragon Ball kind of four kids, very much associated with that kind of stuff, like, heavily altered for television.
Well, they also had Lupin, and then they had Yu Hakusho, and then they were also releasing Blue Gender. So
right, that was it at the time. And Fruits Basket was like for girls, which was new. And then the rest of that stuff is also for girls, but this one was targeted at girls.
And that's what interested me, because it was like, you know, they announced Tenchimiyu GXP, and I was watching some of the fan subs of it at Anime Fest, and I said, "Well, that was cool." Yeah.
Right. Boy, it wouldn't ever work that way ever. Like, again, it would never work that way again for quite some time. Yep. So you came on in 2003?
Yeah. Just a note for people that change your jobs. Get a little bit of space in between, because I worked October 31st at the agency. And then the next day, I worked at Funimation. So, yeah.
Right.
And it was interesting. It was also, you know, your perspective of Funimation at the time was, yeah, it was cartoons. Anime was kind of still foreign, still getting used to it. And then I was this, not a fanboy, but it's kind of like I understood anime and kind of what it represents and mm-hmm. kind of was a fan of it. But then also... And I knew marketing, so I was kind of a little different at the company. I mean, now there's a lot of people at these companies that kind of like grew into it. That was part of their growing up, but you know, right. It's few and far between then.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it was not, especially at the beginning of the 2000s, because the time that you're talking about right now, this is sort of the beginning of the DVD bubble for anime. Like, I want to say 2002 was kind of when it started really taking off, and then 2003 was, you're sort of off to the races at that point. Like, it was a lot of output.
2003, at all the conventions that we went to, I still have a DV cam where I walked all... like at Expo and at Comic-Con, walking through all the booths.
Oh, wow. And you should upload that somewhere.
I have.
Oh, okay.
No. I've shown it at, whenever I did my anime Nostalgia Bomb, I've shown that in the panel. I haven't uploaded it yet.
Oh, but, yeah. I see it. That sounds fascinating.
Yeah, because it's the big, huge Tokyo Pop booths. It's the ADV two-level booths where at Expo you heard...
The drums.
And then everybody would go in droves, and then you would see people throw Nachika panties, box sets, and, you know, everything.
Little bracelets. I did that. I'm sure you've done it a few times. I did it a few times.
Oh, no, I didn't. I just looked at the spectacle mic going, wow.
You never went up there and did that? Like, I'm a little surprised.
No, I didn't.
Their neighbors loved that. Their neighboring booths always loved ADV's drums. Always.
Oh, yeah.
There would have been a huge Bandai Entertainment booth, you know, all that stuff. Jenny on.
Pioneer at the time.
Pioneer. Oh, yeah. Geez. It would have been Pioneer. Big old Tenchi.
Yep.
Yikes. That's a long time ago. So 2003, like, what releases are you working on? What is Lance working on in 2003 at Funimation? Like, what are you doing when you go to work?
Well, 2003 was more of being the kind of the my title. We create titles at the time was fan base marketing. So a lot of it was they were looking for someone to kind of market towards the anime fans, because they were getting Kigure, they were getting Tenchimuyo, Detective Conan was coming out, and then they're starting to license anime.
You mean Case Closed?
Yeah. Yeah, Case
One
Closed.
One Truth Prevails. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
So you were working on ushering those in. And they hired a nerd to talk to the nerds, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so With Fruits Basket, well, part of what I started was that, I mean, they had convention screenings. They had a lot of convention screenings,
right?
But everything was through mail. And one of the first things I did was do the online version called Operation Anime, where a lot of conventions and libraries and schools would you know, submit forms digitally, and then we would send them DVDs,
right?
And so you know, that started. That occurred for years. Mm-hmm. It was we had this binder called Leave No Con Behind, where anytime a convention and library wanted a screening, we would say yes. Mm-hmm. And so we did a like interns and people and coordinators working on that. So it was being more of answering week requests, and Funimation never went to conventions. I mean, they did go to that AX New York. That's where they announced Teenage Mutant GXP, which I knew of. And then they did Expo, but just a little bit on a side of a booth the previous year. But then that year, up in 2013, I did 13 conventions.
Right. A year?
A year.
Yeah, I did 13 conventions that year, and then the first one was Anime Central. Mm-hmm. And then of Anime Central, it was my goal was to educate internally of who their audience is, because as you said, Fruits Basket is a girl show. Mm-hmm. But I brought my DV cam and I did surveys, and then I had four winners every hour, and then I came back with a ton of surveys. And then with the survey winners, I would record them and say, what's your favorite show? What do you think about Funimation? And I thought I would get, you know, every second, well, probably every 10 minutes, I would get someone to say, hey, Funimation, Dragon Ball Z, what are you with edits? I got nothing of that. Mm-hmm. So just kind of like the internal or external. And then, you know, I'd get winners for Fruits Basket. And then I got this burly guy, and the video was, hey, Funimation, I just want to say I love Funimation. I love Dragon Ball Z. And I'm so glad that it won Fruits Basket. It's my new favorite show. And just to show internally that, you know, it's like, yes, Fruits Basket is a comedy drama. You know, it appeals to more than you think. Mm-hmm. And just kind of doing a, this is who your audience is. That's what I did at those conventions. And so that's what I did a Fanime, and it was more Fruits Basket, you know, selling Fruits Basket, because it was January volume 2, March volume 3, and May volume 4. Mm-hmm. So it was really just the Fruits Basket, Blue Gender, where we would sell a little bit, but it was mainly promotion. And then we did the, like, Otakon. We had a 30 by 30 booth, and it was more working with Score, which that was kind of like my first introduction with Adam, who now works at Crunchyroll. He was at Score Entertainment. He did the famed Dragon Ball Z Hummer, the Hummer tour.
Right. Score did the cards. Score did like anime trading card games. Like they did the Dragon. Do they still do that? I've completely lost track of trading card games.
Score got sold to Panini.
Right. Okay. I remember this now. Right. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And then Score also did a Fruits Basket card game as well.
I remember that. I remember thinking, what?
And so that was 2003. So that was all of that. And then I also helped out with acquisitions, just, you know, getting information. A lot of the information was kind of like the new type ratings from Japan. And then Gin's uncle would send over from Japan TV ratings. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of it was looking at the ratings and looking at, you know, there wasn't a whole lot of, you know, manga back then, just didn't come at the pace of it now. So you kind of had to, you know, look at a promotional video and kind of see what you thought of it. Also that year it was, planning for, so in addition to doing Fruits Basket, marketing and Blue Gender box set in October, I was doing the media plans for Dragon Ball GT,
which is like, what is that? You know, so people understand what that means. What is that?
Okay. Well, media plans was, it's kind of like just putting ads. And I mean, back in the day was magazines were still the number one. So you would have DC, Marvel, and Archie Comics with Dragon Ball Z ads. And then...
Right. Those were everywhere.
Oh, yeah. Well, not too much. It was still expensive to do, but back then, the volumes, you had money to work on.
Right.
But really, the success of Dragon Ball Z was all the licensors that did the card games and the video games. That was... And it was on TV. That was the big marketing right there.
Right.
But, you know, the... putting ads and all that stuff helped with the home video. And then also, I got to think if it was 2003 or 2004, it might have been, no, it was 2003. We did, you know, Fruits Basket, we did regular, you know, Animerica and then also was Anime Insider 2000. Yeah. Yeah. We did Anime Insider ads for Fruits Basket. But then we also did an ad in teeny bopper magazines like J14 and Twist.
Right. Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so but that was the last of that. There was also at the time there were Nirvana titles, and then Funimation also did 4Kids Home Video. So I was kind of like the anime person. And then was the time in 2003 where they hired additional people to handle like Nova and Brands, and then more of the anime stuff. And that was more 2004. So yeah, it was kind of building up in 2003 because those were the releases. But then it was whenever you like release a show, like Kitty Grade was released February 2004, Tenchi was in March, and then in May, Funimation in 2004 was Funimation licensed Full Metal Alchemist.
Right,
and I was announced at E3. It was all that planning was also in 2003.
Sure,
sure.
And then you had to work on that. So
I feel like 2004, like some of the stuff that happened here, it was the first time we started seeing a lot of this stuff. So like those hats that you made, that was like American manufactured licensed merchandise for a shoujo property. You know, it was at the time it was like, oh shit, you really struck something here. Those things were also fucking ubiquitous. Like those Fruit Basket hats were absolutely everywhere all the time.
Here's the origin. So in 2003, we had a budget of all those conventions. I have the Excel spreadsheet. It's upstairs in my attic. I can't find it. I every time I went to the conventions, I saved marketing collateral. That's basically all the pamphlets and flyers that you see. So I would, anytime I wanted to do something, I had to prove that it's like, this stuff works.
Mm-hmm.
Here it is. With the Fruits Basket hats, origin of that was... they were done by a licensing partner called Drew Pearson. And Drew Pearson did the hats, the licensing hats for Yu Yu Hakusho and Dragon Ball Z. And the Kitty Grade Volume 1 collector's box had a baseball hat that was embroidered Kitty Grade. That was Drew Pearson.
I remember that.
I worked with the licensing group, and they sent me all the... I looked in their office, and they had all these samples, and there was a Scooby-Doo hat with ears. And... in 2003, going through conventions, also looking at, you know, the Diamond catalog, was Broccoli had a Digico hat that they sold at cons in 2003.
Yeah, I remember that hat.
And then I looked at that Scooby-Doo hat, and I'm like going, hey, could we work on this? Could we make a hat? Because I didn't have budget to go to conventions in 2014, not much. I mean, it was small booths. My San Diego Comic-Con 2003 was a favor for our licensor, Score Entertainment, who had a huge booth for the Yu Yu Hakusho trading card game launch. And I got a sliver of the booth because, you know, you're the parent licensor. So it was on their dime and I had a booth.
Right.
So, and so with those hats, we put them on sale at Akon. And well, first we, you know, got first you had a Kyo and Yuki hat, and then we got approval, and then we got Drew Pearson to do designs on it, and then we said one size fits most, so we got the person with the biggest head at Funimation to try it on, and if it worked, because I said there's gonna be fanboys that are going to like want this too.
Mm-hmm.
And so that worked. And so I put together a spreadsheet and I said, I think this might work. I think it was like a $12,000 purchase order. And we got all these hats and they were in a warehouse, and we sold through so many boxes at Akon, and then it was a success. And then we did the same thing at every convention that we went to. And then, they got for sale in Diamond. Right. You know, we were able to sell it to retail.
I think they were for sale in Suncoast eventually.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah. And that was the coolest thing, was just, you know, going to conventions. And then a coworker of mine, Sophie, still works at Funimation. We would do the hat game where we would walk that year from our, you know, whenever we always stayed at a convention hotel, walked to the convention to go to our booth, we would do hat, 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 hat. And it was crazy.
And those were all kitty grade ball caps, right?
Well, no. That was fruit basket hats.
I know, it was a joke. I know.
It did better than people think.
I'm sure it did. Who was wearing that ball cap though? Like, it was like, hell yeah, I'm gonna put my kitty grade cap on and head out to the ballpark. Whatever.
It was promo stuff. It was part of that was Funimation was getting into anime, and then it was they're just going to do volumes, and all the competition, you know, Pioneer, ADV, and Bandai, they always did volume one collector's box with a promo.
Yeah, with junk. Yeah, with t-shirt. Yeah.
Yep, with t-shirt. And then I went into the marketing VP's office, and also with the new home video VP they hired away from Pioneer, and show them all of my stuff, the stuff that I collected. And it's like, this is what the anime industry does. We need to follow suit. And then the home video VP agreed. And that's how we started doing it and getting the chipboard boxes. Because before the first Yu Yu Hakusho box set, it was just, you know, it's the fold paper box that, you know, it's like people are going to have these on their bookshelf. They've got to be sturdy. So that's what started that.
Wasn't Kotocha around this time?
No, Kotocha was 2005.
Was it? Oh, 5? Jeez. Okay.
I think I can go back, but it was it was a while.
Okay. For whatever reason, my memory puts that as before Full Metal Alchemist.
Well,
but
I think it was 2004 we announced it at Katsukaner Boston.
It was one of those, and you had the little hammers.
Yep. And those hammers was going through one of those tchotchke places, the cheap tchotchke places. And then on my Twitter feed, like about 3 months ago, someone asked about it. I found the date. And then from my files, I actually found the Word doc of the label file that I did where we cut them out and put them on the hammers.
Right.
And we had... on those pallets, because we shipped with Score to go into conventions to save money. And then I just know that I had that pallet at Score that went to like two other conventions because we weren't allowed to announce it yet.
Mm-hmm.
And so those hammers went with us at conventions for a while.
Oh, they just traveled with you in case you were able to announce it?
Yeah, because there were two times that we brought them in. It's like, are we going to announce it? No, crap. Okay.
Right. So that announcement was 2004. In my memory, where did you announce Full Metal Alchemist? That was at E3?
Full Metal Alchemist was, I was not there. It was May 2000.
Yeah, right. But what convention would that have been at?
It was E3. It was Square Enix announced
that. Okay. Right.
Yeah, because it was more of you know, that was the first Square, you know, it was like their first big property. And so, you know, it was the manga, and then they had the video games. And the video games are going to be huge. That was like the main pull was the video games. But then it just so turned out that
that was not the case.
was the anime.
Yeah, totally. And it was over at that point? Like, it had finished airing, I think.
Of what?
Full Metal Alchemist. Like, because it was 2003.
No, Full Metal Alchemist, it was still airing.
Was that I thought that was a spring 2003. I guess it was fall.
Yeah.
I'll have to look it up, but anyway, it's hard to get the exact date.
What I'm doing is I have dual monitors, so what's going to happen is during the forum threads, they're going to say, "No, it was this and this. You got your date wrong. What is this crap?"
That's fine. I'm used to that. I better be used to it at this point after this long.
Yeah.
So at this point, Funimation was also experimenting with, like, you know, major retailers like Walmart. Like, you were getting stuff into, you know, big box stores.
Well, DBZ was always in like the big box stores. So getting those relationships, they were always there.
Right, but putting something that wasn't Dragon Ball was kind of a risk because you risk returns at that point, and Walmart's known to do that.
Yeah, and what happened was it was around that time where you saw Target and Walmart where you had Pioneer, Bandai, and ADV releases in those big boxes.
Right.
And then, you know, we had Fullmetal Alchemist in there, and it didn't take. A couple volumes it was out. Samurai 7, a couple volumes it was out. The only things that still to this day sell our movies at Walmart. Whenever everything switched to a 13 episode series was stuff that kind of stayed in there because you had Walmart had set dates and then you had a certain amount of turn rate that if you didn't hit a turn rate, all your stuff's out.
Yeah.
And it can bury you.
No, they've burned quite a lot of people that way.
Not as much as Suncoast.
Yeah. Well.
Okay. So Fullmetal Alchemist was 2003 to October of 2003 to October 2004.
Right. Right. Yeah. 52. So yeah, it would have been.
Yeah. So whenever this was announced, this was kind of like
in the middle.
of the broadcast. And then in 2004, it was Fullmetal premiered on Adult Swim in November of that same year.
Right. I remember that. And then that was also the year Larkin Shiel was at Otakon, and y'all had that promotion going. Like, you had the opening there and everything. That was great.
That was the hugest favor I had to ask of production.
Oh, really?
Because it was Justin Cook, who was still at Funimation, and I said, Aniplex, the licensors request that the first episode is dubbed for this concert. And then Justin's like, I didn't, it's like, they requested, we have to do it. and so, that was kind of, fingers. I mean, it was going to get done, but that was kind of like, yeah. And then we have the, Funimation had big booths for licensing, and so we had these huge walls that are set up for, that was our first industry booth, you know, and then that was also Case Closed Volume 1, so half of the booth was Case Closed, and half the booth was Fullmetal Alchemist, and that was a trip. That convention was the biggest trip.
Just because...
cosplay... Yeah. And then seeing that band, and then it was wonderful.
Yep, I remember the show. It was a great show. I'll remember that concert for the rest of my life, I think. that's a big one.
And then that next year, it was working with Tofu Records, and so it was I and Yaz Noy, and she does she still works with a lot of bands. I mean, if you go to some of the big huge concerts. I mean, that's kind of her work.
Right.
So we worked with Tofu Records, and then in 2005, they gave us an opportunity to say, hey, Larkin Shiel's going to be performing in concert in 2005. You want to do a contest? And that's when we did Fullmetal Alchemist Biggest Fan Contest.
Oh yeah.
Remember that? Yeah. And then we had two winners, and then they got, you know, a good amount of spending cash, and then they could pick one person to go, and they got spending cash. And it's like A&A flew us there. We went to Sony hotels and was there for about 4 days, 4 or 5 days. And then took your former boss, Rob Brick, in there, and he covered it. And went to that concert. That was a trip. Everything was a trip. And it was 14 years ago.
Yeah. Yep.
14 years ago. That's crazy.
Well, so these years, the 2004 to like 2006, I feel like Fullmetal Alchemist kind of dominated Funimation's presence for a couple years there. It was a while.
Yeah. Yeah, but then that was whenever the still Dragon Ball Z was
that's always looming.
Was kicking ass because they, you know, those are the orange bricks where they just, I mean, that how that, you know, once that kind of, I think that was 2000. When did those bricks come out? We called them orange bricks in the office.
Everyone and called them orange bricks.
Yeah. Once they're out, I mean, they sold so much. And, cause like part of it was, I was more of just, you know, my focus was anime. Mm-hmm. I didn't focus too much on Dragon Ball Z. Cause you know, one person just handled Dragon Ball Z. It's like, well, I'll just handle all the anime. I didn't handle all the anime, you know, senior brand manager, then director of marketing, all that, you know, it's like de facto, I've got all the anime. Mm-hmm. You know, I had other brand managers that contributed, but kind of just kind of like the de facto kind of like, here's anime, here's where we go. Mm-hmm. And we had a marketing director and then we had another marketing director, but that was kind of like, my focus was more of just kind of like the roadmap for anime and then how to like talk to fans. Cause whenever I first worked there, it was like, we don't have an online presence. And so I got on, you know, Anime News Network and, you know, answered questions. Anime and DVD went on there, answered questions, had a dedicated thread on Toon Zone. Right. That went on and answered questions. So it was more of, you know, back in the day, it's like that was social media. That's how you contacted and got to know people. I loved Anime and DVD because it was like, you know, you had all the reps. Answered questions. I mean, Jerry Chu had an IRC channel. Jerry Chu was Bondi. He did IRC panels.
Yep, I remember those.
You know, it's just like, you know, all these people go, oh, we're doing this stuff. And like, yeah, whatever, we did it before.
New. Right. So you're doing that outreach. Full Metal Alchemist is coming out. At this point, you get purchased, or Funimation gets purchased by Navarre. So what is the, like, what's the office culture at Funimation like in this period? Like, is it a couple of nerds and then a bunch of sort of executive type people, or like, you know, what's it like there?
Oh no. See, the thing is, it's like, we didn't have a whole lot of executive people. Mm-hmm. It was still, just kind of, you know, you had home video and then, kind of, you had meetings where it was like two people from home video. You had Gin, you had the person from, and then you had people from marketing, you had people from production, and then you just kind of decided stuff. You kind of worked on a room and everybody was consensus. And it's still like that these days. It's just, you know, whenever I was there, Funimation was never kind of corporate. It's just, you know, you've got some people that are just numbers based.
Right.
And then you have creative. And so you had people that were black and white. And then people that were all full of color, and marketing is, you got to make everything gray. You've got to let, you know, home video and accounting understand that, well, if we do this little thing, if we tweak it this way, if we do this, that's what our consumers want. That's kind of, this is who our, what our market wants. And it was our kind of idea just to have proof, social proof and just physical proof, or just, well, let's just do this one thing and just test it. And if it worked, then we could do more things.
That stands to reason, I think. So during this period, so you've got Dragon Ball, which is kind of the cash cow. And then you have Full Metal Alchemist, which is, I guess, a new one. Like, that's sort of the number two.
Yeah,
at that point.
Sold, you know, on video skin and everything. Oh, gosh. So many units.
Right.
But then also like with Fruits Basket, it was like Fruits Basket was never over. The heyday of Fruits Basket was 2002, 2006, where we did a repricing campaign 2014. We did the big box set in 2004, holiday campaign. It got into Best Buy in 2006. And by 2010, Fruits Basket, if you comboed the volumes 1 through 4, it sold 100,000 units.
Wow.
Yeah. It sold a lot. That was, it's in the top five of Funimation properties. So of course, whenever the remake comes out, hey, Funimation, do you want this? Of course we want that.
Yeah,
so,
we're going to put the first couple episodes in theaters.
Yeah.
So during this period, so you also licensed something called Galaxy Railways back in the day, which I remember at the time I think everyone was like, well, at least on my side of the aisle there, it was like, okay, good luck. Good luck with that one. As much as I love Leiji Matsumoto, it just didn't seem like it would sell.
Yeah. It was getting that was Prinoy Tamina. So right. That was more of our relationship building.
Oh, I see. Okay. So yeah. This was also another, you guys went fucking nuclear on Samurai 7, which was Gonzo's remake of Seven Samurai.
I went nuclear because I had a budget and then I had some track record. So
y'all did crazy stuff for Samurai 7.
Yeah.
So the craziest thing that most people will know about, if people know about this at all, they've probably heard the legend of the samurai swords, where y'all had a little set of like, they were like mini swords, right? They weren't like,
no, it was full. It was not mini. It was full size swords.
Full size swords.
Three full size swords. And if you look at a Phantom post on, with Chris Beveridge, whenever he shows what he's watching, it's on his TV cabinet.
Yeah,
he still has those.
I think we had a set of them in the Anime Insider offices too. Yeah. Thing.
I had to say goodbye to mine 2 years ago. I had way too much space.
It's a pretty big thing. So, and you also put out these huge collector's edition boxes for each volume. What was in those? Because so I was at a book off the other day and saw like the whole collection of these things sitting on a shelf.
We mirrored Gonzo's release.
So it's just it's like art books and stuff in there, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So we had the book translated, and then we had all the layers. So we translated all the layers. Then the book had storyboard. So we had the storyboard.
Right.
And then the boxes. We did the boxes. Yeah. And so we did that. Was it crazy? Yes. Did they sell? Yes.
Did the show sell?
Yeah. Yeah. It really sold.
Because it didn't seem like people loved it. Like, people didn't really love that show. I don't hear people talk about, like, it's not like it had, like, a fan base. You know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah. Well, it was, speaking of a fan base, go to 2007 with Witchblade.
Sure.
I mean that show, only five episodes are fan-subbed, but it was one of our top sellers of that year.
What a shocker that is.
Mm-hmm.
Let me tell you how stunned I am. So, I understand that the loudest fans are not always.
Right. Just with the swords. I was at a convention, of course. It was Akon. There was one of the sword dealers that lived in New Orleans. I got his contact info. I was looking at these swords and I'm like going, I have an idea. And then I said, could you give me an offer on 100 swords? And so he got back to me and then I said, so I bought one. I put together a little label. Put together a don't kill yourself, you know, like a little label.
Yeah, the height of responsibility.
Put it in a room, put it in the conference room, asked our lawyer, and I said, take a look at this. And she looked at it and said, wow. And I said, I want this as our retail promo kit. And then she looked at it and she goes, okay, I got the approval. And I, you know, went to a box company in Dallas. I got a box sized for it, shipped them out. The only one that got returned was whenever we sent one to the armed forces.
Oh, really?
For review. And so, of course, that came back. And I think the one from Canada came back as well. But yeah, that was fun.
Yeah. Well, they still exist out there. I think I've seen one or two of them on eBay before.
Oh, really? Cool.
I think. I'm pretty sure. But during this period...
I should have put mine on eBay then.
Yeah, really? So during this period, you also did the first Full Metal Alchemist movie, but you did a theatrical release for that, right? Which was new for you at the time, I think.
Yeah, that was one of the... We were the guinea pigs for Fathom Events. It was Anime Bento, and that was Robotech Shadow Chronicles, a Lupin movie.
Oh, right, Robotech Shadow Chronicles.
Full Metal Alchemist. And that release, that was my first burnout at Funimation.
Really? So what was it about that?
Oh, it was, they were so focused on pre-orders So whenever everybody, people complain, like, how come it's not in my town, blah, blah, blah. It was like 60 days out. If a city didn't get a pre-order, mm-hmm. boom, oh, that town was dropped.
Really?
60 days in advance. And then by that time, Full Metal got super popular. And once a title gets super popular, that's when the licensors have kind of more of a... you know, projects are more visible. And so the scrutiny on like approvals and timings and everything. And so there was a release date change that that happened that wasn't notified to licensors in advance. Mistake on my part. You know, it just, there was just so many things in the air because, you know, it was doing, let's see, when was that? Yeah, that was in 2007. Mm-hmm. Sorry, that was 2006. And by that time, you know, Full Metal Alchemist was still releasing volumes. You know, it was like 9, 10, 11, 12, 13. It was like almost every 2 months mm-hmm. there was a new volume. And I did media plan on those. In addition to doing Galaxy Railways, Samurai 7, went to that trip in Japan. Then I had Full Metal Panic, and then in May 2006, we had Tokyo Pop DVD distribution. And so all that was, you know, doing a lot of stuff. And I didn't even mention that, I don't know if it was 2005 or 4. I also did Beyblade.
Oh, yeah.
And so, yeah, it's, did I take on too much? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And then we also launched the Full Metal Funimation channel in 2006, and I was also a part of that. So,
were you responsible for marketing on the Tokyo Pop stuff? Like, is that how that works?
It was distribution,
right?
Tokyo Pop did their own marketing.
Okay, so you're just handling distribution. But what were you working on that?
No, right. I wasn't. I mean, a lot of that was a lot of the products are already made.
Right, sure. You're just
more of a distribution, but. You know, I mean, they had that weird Tokyo Nights where it was all the cars and the ladies in bikinis.
Yeah, I remember that.
One or two episodes where there was nudity in it.
Didn't they put out one of those like car soccer things too? Like car football? They put out some shit.
It wasn't another part of stuff.
That's 2006, I think we're still talking, and that was the year where Suncoast fell. The first wave, I think.
Yeah, it was the Suncoast Sam Goody that had major store closures.
Right, so those returns, I think in the early going, really hit places like Media Blasters really hard. Media Blasters and CPM, I think, both got hit really, really hard by that. So did ADV.
Well,
but the damage on ADV wouldn't show for a couple of years.
Yeah, well, part of that was just kind of to let everybody know about sell-through and sell-in. Right. So whenever we solicit stuff to retailers, it's 90 days in advance mm-hmm. was solicitation. That's why, you know, Suncoast was huge in the pre-orders.
Right.
We're always in pre-orders. And did our marketing months in advance just to get the pre-orders because the cutoff date was 30 days in advance.
Right.
Then you would wait, and then once it got released, then you do more marketing. So with sell-in, so you had a title, and then like Suncoast would sell in 10,000 units. And, you would get that money.
Wait,
but
hang on. This is fascinating.
Yeah.
So Suncoast is buying 10,000 units of what?
I'm just for an example.
Well, sure, but
if there was a title within, you know, with any of the years, like whenever, because they buy in wholesale.
Right, exactly.
And so wholesale, like, I mean, not even like one show. Well, I mean, think of it in aggregate, kind of like within a month, Suncoast might buy 30 to 50,000 of your shows if you had a lot of shows.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, some of those would hit, and some of them wouldn't.
It's just that's so much. That's so much. Like, when you say 10,000, I'm like, were they buying 10,000 units of Galaxy Railways Volume 2?
Oh, no. Part of it is. I'm just kind of like Don't think of 10,000 just as just think of it as an aggregate.
Sure. Okay.
It would probably be more of like, let's just say like 3,000, because I mean, a lot of these shows, it was my model got busted in 2006 when Suncoast was closing, but I had a spreadsheet because I had a Nielsen home video scan. So I knew all the sales, and then there were like online retailers like Right Stuff. They didn't report the video scan, but we knew what they sold. So it was a video scan multiplier. Mm-hmm. So I knew, if you subscribed to Nielsen Video Scans, you knew what ADV was selling in units. You knew what Bondi and Pioneer, because, you know, if you subscribed, you would report. And so you could see all the sales.
Right.
And, those were sell through. These are reported through the retailers. And so you would see of that week, what was like, you know, Best Buy, Walmart, what the companies were buying per title. I mean, what the customers were buying per title. Mm-hmm. And whenever we were acquiring something, if it was sort of like a similar title, I said, well, you know, we could sell X amount for acquisitions because based on this track record of these shows from volume one to volume six, I had this spreadsheet of sales that I would hit the numbers. You know, I had a really good predictor of what a title would sell. But then that all went to crap in 2006 because you had store closings. You had, you know, digital coming up. You had Blu-ray and HD DVD coming out, and you know, everything was in flux. To come back to like the sell through, so like if you had 3,000 units at a retailer, mm-hmm. and if the show is crap, it might have sold like 600 units,
right?
Well, everything is returnable, so of 3,000 and you have 600 only sold, 90 days earlier, 30 days earlier, like Suncoast would cut you a check for the full 3,000 wholesale. Mm-hmm. If they sold through 6,000, then they would slowly return from each store. They have a warehouse, and the warehouse didn't sell, and they go to the warehouse. And sometimes the warehouse would just stockpile returns.
Right.
And then the companies could just flat out just return a crap load of stuff for you. So, you know, if that 3,000 of only 600 sold, they could return 2,400.
Right.
And you're due for those 2,400. You owe Suncoast that amount back.
Right. And so
even though you get that money, it's not really you sold that many because that's a sell through.
Yeah. You have to sit on that until you know what has sold through.
And so returns killed companies.
Yes,
and
that was kind of the beginning of the bubble burst, right?
Yeah, yeah, because it was partly, you know, the company's fault and also these stores, because these stores would just sit on inventory and not return it. And then whenever they would close, it's like, you know, the old story of Fry's being the anime museum.
Right, you'd
walk into Fry's and see old crap. Well, they just didn't return it. And then they would finally return it, and then you would have to pay them back. And so what saved Funimation from all that, partially it was Dragon Ball Z.
Right.
But a lot of it was the CEO for Navarre had a strict mandate for Funimation saying you have to be at 20% returns. So a lot of it was Funimation short-shipped. And short-shipped meaning that, you know, if like a Suncoast needed, 2,000 units, Funimation might send them 1,000 because Funimation was like, they don't need that many.
Yeah.
So they would ship them. It was more kind of like a just-in-time inventory. And that's how Funimation never really got crippled.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of glorified consignment in a way.
Yeah.
It's just like, except you're given this money and they're like, well, don't do anything with that yet. I'm not sure I'm going to sell all of these. Doesn't sound like a great way to do business.
So, I mean, that's what happened.
Right, so that's kind of the beginning of the bubble burst, and y'all were sitting pretty at the time. I mean, dominant at the time. It felt like that anyway.
Because you had Dragon Ball Z, the bricks, and you had Full Metal, and then you had Afro Samurai was hitting.
Right, yeah, that was a big deal.
And then Yu Yu Hakusho was, you know, sold a lot.
Yeah. Well, you know, and again, like pretty much everything you listed was on Adult Swim, which was still extremely relevant at the time. Like, still the way a lot of people got into anime was by watching Toonami and, you know, watching Full Metal Alchemist at 11:30 at night or whenever it was on.
To backtrack around like 2005 was 2005 ASIN or 2006 ASIN. And then I can visually see whenever you went to a convention and you saw like the guest lineup and the lines for panels and the lines for autographs, it was kind of the Japanese creators and licensors were like big draws. And then the voice actors were draws.
Mm-hmm.
But then around that time, right, that shift was whenever the voice actors were the main draws for conventions. And I saw that at an ASIN for Full Metal Alchemist, and I saw that at an Anime Next. I think it was Anime Next 2005, where the lines went forever for the autographs.
Now, I've been going to anime conventions about... No, I haven't been going longer than you. 2000 was my first one.
Yeah.
So I've been going to these about as long as you have.
Yeah.
And to me, the lines for the English voice actors were always longer than they were for the Japanese guests. It was always like that.
Okay.
That's my recollection anyway. You get people to sign it. Like, if you had Toriyama there, sure. But if you had, like, the director of a season of Dragon Ball, or a few it wouldn't work that way. If you had the director of a few episodes of Dragon Ball, his autograph line's going to be short. But Sabat's line is going to be really long. Shemmel's line is going to be really long. It's always like that. Unless you have Toriyama himself.
Yeah. It might have been the length of the lines, but
yeah.
it just got crazy.
Yeah. Well, I think that... When did Takahashi show up at Comic-Con? It was in the mid-2000s, wasn't it? Or late 2000s? What's that?
Can you repeat that?
When did Takahashi show up at Comic-Con? It was like the late 2000s, I think.
I don't remember.
That's like a Japanese guest where their line would be longer than Shemmel or whatever. But yeah, so 2007 was also the first you guys did. Well, no, that wasn't you. That was ADV that did the American Anime Awards, right?
Where Full Metal Alchemist got the majority of the awards.
It did. You had like a shelf full of them, didn't you? This was the one that looked like Mazinger.
Yes. Yes. And then whenever we moved into our new offices, we had them on glass shelves. And then 3 weeks later, the glass shelves were too heavy, and they fell on the awards.
Oh, no. So were they all destroyed?
Yes. And so I think that was a harbinger of...
Wait. Are you saying they weren't solid gold?
I know. And also in the American Anime Awards, I've posted that to YouTube.
You have, yes. People can see this if they want.
ADV. So if they want to search for American Anime Awards, they can find that. But that was when... ADB and their anime network, they streamed that live.
Yep.
And it was such a production. It was awestruck. I mean, it was a lot of money and a lot of production.
Yeah, it was. They had, what's his name from Conan's writer's room? Pierre Bernard? Was that his name?
And then they had was America's Top Model costume person or... It was weird, just kind of going up there and accepting an award and then seeing everybody and then just kind of like, my thing was just like, why are you doing this now? It's like all the titles that they just released, none of them were ready for the awards. I think they worked with ICV2 on the awards about all the, about picking all the winners. Cause it was just odd. I'm like going, okay, Anime Network is hosting this, but then none of the ADB titles were there because they're just releasing a lot of those, you know, all the Shoujits titles that they got.
I think I did an interview with them at the time that was like, so you're sure this isn't just going to be rigged in favor of ADB?
It was probably deliberate because it's like going, they probably just like, we want this to be an agnostic anime awards and whatever was out that year, that's what we're going to promote. I mean, I think they had pure intentions.
Sure. Yeah.
It just you know, I mean, you think that the party's never going to end. So why not?
It was right around the corner for ADV, though. Like, this is about a year out from from really bad news for that company.
And then a month
later, Genion closes.
Yeah, a month after this anime awards, Jinneon announced they're closing.
Right. It was, oh shit, there are major consequences for from the bubble bursting. Jinneon was actually the first out.
Yeah.
They were out real quick, but they also had a glut of stuff.
When was CPM?
I don't remember, but it was, I thought it was after Jinneon. They hung on for a little longer, didn't they?
Yeah, maybe.
I can't quite remember, but that was March 2007 is when Jinneon went down. And that was a major loss. Like, they were a huge player still when they went out.
They were OG. I mean, it was like that's where a lot of people cut their teeth.
3 or 4 years earlier, you would have been sitting in their press suite, you know, and they would have spent way too much money promoting something that wasn't really going to catch on.
Oh, I remember, this takes me back to whenever Anime Expo was in Anaheim.
Yep.
Where I think that was probably like my second year. It might have been like 2004. Yeah, I think it was like 2004, where there was a, Viz had a Ranma, kind of like it was like the last of Ranma. Mm-hmm. And so they were having a party for like the last Ranma release. And then there was a Marriott on one side, the Hyatt on the other side, and the Hyatt had limos, and it was people from ADB going to a party.
I remember that.
And so I was like going, fuck, because I didn't have like hardly any budget to do a booth. And Fullmetal Alchemist proved that we needed to spend at conventions.
Did it? So what, how do you arrive at that conclusion? Like, the show is popular, so we need to be spending a lot of money at cons? Because, like, the ADV executive class getting themselves limousines is not necessarily, certainly no, at the time.
No. The thing is about, that is excess.
Yeah.
The whole point of Anime Expo is impress Japanese. Right. You are a big player in America.
Mm-hmm.
That's why you only see trade show booths at Expo. You don't see them anywhere else.
Right.
We had trade show booths for Otakon for a while, but all of our stuff was warehoused in California, and to ship all that stuff to Otakon wasn't feasible.
Well, it also doesn't have the industry presence.
Yeah, we used to.
Back in the day. Not anymore.
I mean, that's one of my favorite cons.
Yeah, absolutely. But, it's just not what AX is. There's no comparison anymore.
Well, with AX, it's just because like that's where all the meetings are held. Like if you want to be a fly in the wall, go to the JW Marriott and you see everybody in tables. That's where all the deals are done. So, hey, person, next year, put in some secret microphones under all the tables and you can hear all the business stuff.
I promise you it's extremely boring.
Oh, it's extremely boring, but just to be a fly on the wall. Some of these are boring. That would be fun. If someone's industrious, they will do that.
Yeah, sure.
Why did I say that? That'd be funny. But, you know, I mean, that's where the industry parties happen, and the industry party was mainly because of, Chris did sweet parties before, and then they kind of became their own thing, where there's an industry party.
Yeah, it's still its own thing.
And then, you know, AX did their kind of industry awards for a while, but, you know, those stopped. But that's where the licensors go, and they kind of, that's really their only exposure. They don't go to any other convention. So what they see at that convention is their reality. So, you know, it was a battle to be the first booth at the front of the convention center. Who has the biggest booth? Who has this? Who has that?
These were also days when you could have held an industry party in a hotel suite and people wouldn't have been like, what the fuck is this?
Yeah.
That would have been like, oh, fancy. You can afford a suite.
Yeah. And so, you know, you still have, your trade show booths. What's interesting of, like, last year's expo was different players. I mean, you've got the traditional publishers and distributors in Japan having their own booths.
Yeah, right.
Their own stuff.
Yep. And now it's kind of a mix of both. Although we'll see how it goes this year. So that's, you know, 2007 is when bad news is kind of starting to really come down. And then in 2008 is when things really start getting weird. So 2008 is kind of, I want to say it was the last really bad year, although 2009 I feel was kind of low tide as well. But the rebound was not, it didn't take that long. It didn't seem like it took that long.
The rebound took a while.
It was like two or three years, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It was 2 or 3 years, but nothing really. It was more of, your retailers were, Suncoast, Best Buy, Walmart, Right Stuff, and then Amazon. And then, now you've kind of, your majority retailers, Amazon. And some Best Buy, because there was times within the aughts where Suncoast was your number one retailer, and then they went away. Best Buy was your number one retailer, and then back in 2009 and 2008, with all these retail reporters, and digital is going to kill physical releases. I mean, that was like comic books and home video and everything. And then you had Best Buy drinking the punch and just understanding that, and they thinking that was true, and they cut their anime section by 50%, because with Best Buy's they had like different sets of like an A, B, C, G, E, where you would be either a one column, two column, or three column, and these columns were sets of anime, and they're all different within each store. And then in 2010 they took out the horror and Kung Fu live action. In the Kung Fu live action, when you looked at video scan, Best Buy wiped out that industry.
Hmm.
Because 90% of those sales came from Best Buy.
Wow.
Yeah. Oh, I had in my notes, April 2009 was Central Park Media dissolved.
Okay, so they outlasted both Genion and the original version, original form of ADV.
Yeah, because like with 2008 was, last issue of New Type, and they came out with Peak. That only lasted 4 issues.
Yeah,
Tokyo
Peak.
Pop announced their restructure. And then July 2008 was Funimation announced they're distributing Genion titles. So,
yeah, so
titles.
There was a crazy.
That same month, Funimation is. Got the Sojitz titles that were formerly ADV.
Yeah, y'all basically scooped up the remains, the carcasses of these companies. You scooped up everything they had and went forward from there. And you were sort of the major distributor there for a little while. Like,
and that
the
was
one.
That was the 2008, 2009 was the other time that, that was the craziest time, because you had Funimation releasing all these new titles, and then you're picking up, Genion titles, and you're picking up ADV titles, and some of those ADV titles were in the middle of releasing. So how do you release them?
Yeah, that was really sudden. I remember getting a panicked phone call from a friend of mine at ADV at AX that year. It was like right after we had just finished our panel, I think. Maybe it was our panel that we did, the ANN panel at Anime Expo 2008. It would have been 2008. I got a phone call, panic, like, so some shit's about to go down. He's like, we're no longer partners with Sojitz. And I was like, oh, wait, what is that? He's like, it's like 60 things. I was like, oh, my God. So, yeah, it was not a good weekend for the folks at ADV.
And just to let listeners know, it's like, I had friends at ADV, friends at Bandai. We, at all these conventions, we kind of knew each other. And then,
of course.
You also know that, all the people that run the conventions. So you had a con family. I called it summer camp, where you would see all your industry buddies.
Summer camp that lasts like 7 months.
Yeah. And then like in 2009, all your friends went away.
Yeah.
Sucked.
Yeah, those were kind of dark days. And it lasted for a while. It did last for a little while. In hindsight,
in 2009, we had a 10% layoff. I had to let people go in my department.
Right.
It sucked. And then March 2009, like it sucked for you because Anime Insider went away.
Well, I had been gone for 4 years at that point. I left in 05.
Yeah, you were A&N at the time.
I left for A&N in 05. I wasn't at Anime Insider for about a year. Like, I didn't like I didn't like New York, so I got Chris called me up and offered me a job, and I was like, where can I live? And he's like, you can live wherever you want. You work from home. I was like, okay, moving to California. See you later. Yeah. I loved working there, and I loved the people I worked with, but I just couldn't handle New York. Yonkers. Or no, I didn't live in Yonkers. I lived in Nyack, which was like an hour
north.
Call
me Yonkers.
Yeah, sure. You know, that sounds like a great idea for the cover of a DVD.
I know. Call me Yonkers.
Yes. So 2009, things are still kind of shitty. That's when Best Buy cuts their anime section. Central Park Media's out of business. A lot of stuff is happening. The first episode of this show, we were discussing ADV's restructuring.
The Phoenix.
Sentai Filmworks and Acer Holdings and Made in Japan and all that stuff. You know, like, who do they think they're kidding? And kind of that tone. But they came back pretty fast. It was like a year later they were back in business for the most part.
Yeah, and still around, still alive and kicking.
But this was also the year that Borders started going down.
Yeah.
That was when
the Suncoast stores.
Yeah, the wall started crumbling there. Last of the Suncoast. So it's kind of the old world being washed away, and we're sort of, this is where you can see the streaming horizon, right? Sort of.
Well, the streaming horizon was around
It's hard to remember, but I know this was around now, like the end of the 2000s, beginning of the 2010s, was around when you started kind of seeing, maybe streaming, like maybe a little bit.
Well, in 2007, we started, in 2004 and 2005, we worked with Real Media to stream Samurai 7.
I remember.
And then
quality
we worked in 2007, where we were one of the first studios on iTunes, and we were one of the first studios at launch for PlayStation 3.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, but in terms of like going online and watching your anime online, that was kind of, but you're not using fan subs. You're not using fan subs. We're watching a digital version of the show from an official licensor. That was sort of just over the horizon this point.
And in 2006, that's when Crunchyroll broke the mold, and you know they found the perfect user interface for watching online, and you know, lo and behold, AT&T. So
yeah,
I mean, it's been around for a while.
It sure has. But during these years, you know, about the end of the 2000s is when you know the old stuff starts to kind of fade, and we go into kind of a what feels a little bit like a gray period where DVD had not quite. DVD and Blu-ray were still the dominant means of making money in this field. That and merchandise, of course. Streaming had not really turned around and become a profit center yet. And so, but at the same time, DVD had just gone through this gigantic wound, like it had been fatally stabbed and was bleeding out, but it was still alive. So things kind of truck along for a few years. This is when Funimation wound up getting sold back to Gen Fukunaga, right?
Yeah, that was Navarre, because Navarre bought Encore and they bought another company that was Home Video that did, you know, He-Man and all the
right
and that stuff. And so Navarre just wanted to get out of doing, you know, that was their thing. They wanted to own the content. And then,
like everyone else,
it's like, you know what? We're not going to do that.
Mm-hmm. So you wound up going back to Gen. Did that change things? Like, what was it like around the office? Were you happy to be back just on your own?
It's kind of the same.
Kind of the same. Things didn't really change much, huh?
It's really just normal operating procedure the entire time. I mean, the day to day was because Navarre was good that they just let us do our thing. It was like, if we hit the numbers, we're good. We always hit our numbers. It was just that one blip in 2009 where, you know, it's like they kind of just hiccuped, you know, everybody thinking that the economy's wrong. We did a layoff. And then a couple months later, some of the people, we got busy that they got hired back.
Well, it's also like, I look at this timeline and it's like July 2008, we take on like 100 new shows from all these other places.
Yeah.
And what, 2 months after that, the economy just explodes. just like die, just rattles its last dying breath. So that must, and then, so then in 2009, you go through these 10% layoffs. It's really not that bad. Like, ultimately, like the company didn't suffer that much through one of the worst economic downturns in history and a gigantic bubble burst in physical media that happened years beforehand, you know, not necessarily as a result of the economic crash.
Yeah. And then, cause with Funimation, it was, you still had Dragon Ball Z with just, you know, just kind of sold and sold. And then you had Full Metal Alchemist. Then you had all the new titles. And then you had a lot of catalog. So with all these companies going away, you had all these catalog titles that you had so many more people getting into anime saying, what do I watch? What do I collect? And then, you know, there was all these good titles that's why we did like the quote classics line.
Right.
Where it was, these are always going to be, another term is called evergreen, folks.
Yeah.
It's the term that's like, this is the show that people would recommend, that people buy. It's going to be in your collection. Think of like all the Ghibli movies. It's like, that is going to be evergreen forever.
Yeah. It's something you have reason to keep in print.
Right.
Yeah. When was Save introduced?
Oh my gosh. I'll have to.
It was like the late 2000s, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Whose idea was that Greenspine?
I think I could do like a YouTube because we did so many videos for the Save edition.
Yeah, right. But whose idea was the Greenspine?
Art.
Yeah.
It was art and home video where they wanted to make it where you could see it. Part of the thing was at the time at retail when Best Buy was closing stuff, a lot, majority of your stuff used to be the face of the DVD cover you would always see. But then a lot of the stuff, there was so much product in the market that everything was spine.
Right.
Save was an answer to spine.
Oh, I see.
Like, this is Save. This is a discount product.
Well, and also, like you said, I think you said it on this show, you were like, well, this is also like stuff that's going out of print. Like, we're not going to make more after this run.
No, it's not after the run. It's with Save. It's at the time it was, you do a volume release, or then, you know, it was like a part one and a part two, 13 episodes, mm-hmm. and then you do a box set. And then 2 years later, you do another box set. The reason why you do multiple box sets is because with retailers, that's when they would sell it in to the retail. Cause instead of having something old, you just let it rest and then you re-release it to get it back in the retail.
Right.
But with all these titles that didn't really sell well, why would a retailer want it in their stores?
Right. So you give them a bargain version with the whole thing.
Well, the thing, it's like, this is the last time we're going to be releasing this as a box set.
Right.
It doesn't mean that we're never going to print anymore, because it's different than printing.
Oh, I see.
Discs. You have to have so many. It's just like, you can always replicate a disc, and then printing a DVD cover is cheap.
This is the last version of this that we're going to release.
Yeah, so it's the last version, last price. And then you have all your evergreen shows that, why discount a Fooly Cooly to $20 where people are always going to buy it? Keep it at 50. And so it's that was the play on that. Because the reason of doing the classics in the Save was just that influx of all the titles that we had. I mean, this, I think it was, like, whenever Funimation was up to like 300 titles that was in the, that, you know, you had the licenses for.
Right.
And now it's more than that. I mean, it was a lot to manage. And with the brand managers, you know, launching a new show, it was a way of maintaining a title's life without a marketing budget, was putting together a Save campaign where you kind of brand that. And so if people liked that, I'm like, yeah, it was pretty good for $20. What else did they have? And then you kind of check what else was like, okay, I'll give this a flyer. Because there are some shows that you'll collect. And if you have a collection, and then there are some shows like going, yeah, I wouldn't buy that at 50, but it's kind of like doing a rental on a movie. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm not going to pay $12 for that movie. I'll check it out a rental. Or why would I pay $12? Some movies, you pay $12 for the movie, and then you pre-order the movie, and you get it. Mm-hmm. Well, then some movies are like, I'll buy this movie at $10.
Sure.
To have it in my collection. And mm-hmm. that's what's safe.
Right. Interestingly, they're doing that same thing again, where they're just kind of re-releasing absolutely everything in budget editions, like everything from the last couple of years, but it's called Essentials now. and it's just the original cover with a gray stripe at the top.
Essentials. I mean, that was, wasn't that Pioneer's name?
I think so. Anime. No, it was Bandai, right? Didn't they call it Anime? No, Anime Legends was Bandai.
It's all those words. And then Classics kind of works to an extent, but then you get to a point where, you know, a title fits it, but is this really a classic?
I was just looking at it and like Drifters is in there and it's like, that ain't a classic.
all those words are a price point.
Oh, totally. Yeah, no, duh. I mean, right, of course.
No, I'm just saying that for the audience. We know that, but just for the audience.
That's funny. Yeah, the essentials are like $25 to $30, and the classics are like $30 to $50.
Yeah.
Like, that's basically it. And that's what they're kind of doing now, still. Anyway, back to your timeline here. So the early 2010s, you know, a little bit of a gray period there.
And part of the gray period was Blu-ray got established because, you know, it was about between HD TV and Blu-ray. And I think I think HD TV would have worked better for the industry because with Sony, with the Blu-ray, you had to pay a license for every disc that you had. And people were always bitching, was like, well, how come, you know, Blu-ray is always $10 more?
Mm-hmm.
That's why. You know, and I think it wasn't us, it was, you know, the major movie companies and TV companies. I think if they just put Blu-ray out at the same price of DVD, it would have been adopted better. It was a lot of its adoption because people are still buying DVD. They're still buying DVD stuff. A lot of TV shows to this day are still released on DVD, not Blu-ray. So
that
gray area, I mean, that's kind of a decision to outside of, you know, this is a niche home video market was, out of our control.
Right. Yeah. Things got kind of odd.
Very odd.
So that was close to your time, the end of your tenure at Funimation. And from what I understand, the corporate culture there changed quite a lot over the course of those years. Like, they brought in a lot of folks from Universal, and things changed there a lot, right?
It mainly started around 2014 when, you know, it's just kind of things just, corporate cultures changed, people kind of leave, and I just decided that, you know, my voice wasn't kind of getting out there, and then I kind of moved on to, I was asked to move on to different projects, different side projects. I wasn't day-to-day with anime, and I overstayed my welcome.
Well, all right. I mean, you know, you were there for a really long time. You decided to leave at some point, basically.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, cause, you know, perspective is, you know, I had a great run there. I kind of like influenced the industry in part. And, you know, at the end of the day, it's just kind of my philosophy to like brand managers, like at the end of the day, we're selling cartoons. You know, we are providing a bit of relaxation for a person that maybe has a crappy job or just kind of been overworked, and at night they just want to watch one of their favorite shows, and we just want to present it in a good quality that they can afford to watch. And that's kind of and if they have a question, let's answer it. If there's problems with our releases, let's fix it. And just be nice, kind of. Just you have a question, they have a question, answer it. Don't answer it in marketing bullshit speak. Just kind of talk on their level.
I mean,
that's kind of like the philosophy I had.
I was curious. So the industry has changed. You were there for all of it and still are.
Yeah.
How do you feel about the direction the industry is going in? Because before it was, when I say mom and pop, I mean independently owned companies that weren't like publicly traded, right?
Yeah.
These are companies that would not dream of an IPO. You know, now,
well,
besides
Funimation did have that as a consideration.
I'm sure once. You did.
I mean, they were part of company, but yeah.
Right. You were part of Navarre. That was as big as it got. But even Navarre was not fucking AT&T or Sony, you know.
No, but I just know that, you know, with Funimation, I mean, the goal was to play with the majors.
Exactly.
I mean, you have to shoot for high goals.
Of course.
No,
I'm not saying they weren't shooting for that stuff.
Oh, yeah.
But it didn't quite get there. Now it feels like it is approaching what they were going for to begin with.
Yeah.
Maybe they're there already. So it's totally different now. How do you feel about that?
Well, I just know that that whenever I left 4 years ago, you know, I had conversations with companies, and you know, they're asking me, is it going to bust? When is anime going to bust? Anime still hasn't busted. All the, you know, all the insane prices for shows, doing the dubs, simulcast day and date, all those risks paid off because Funimation got sold and Crunchyroll got bought, and you know, all these risks that these companies have taken have paid off. The only problem is that if you're a big company, you've got to perform. And now you have, you know, Netflix saying they're going to go in more anime. You know, see Amazon doing a whole lot. So it's kind of, you've got like a big three globally, because it's not just the license in the US, it's licenses for world. So, you know, you kind of, the last of the mom and pops is Sentai, and then anime, you know, all the anime, and then you've got manga. I don't know if they're manga. Yeah, they're manga.
I believe Media Blasters is technically still.
Yeah. And I mean, you've got Discotech with all those, but you know, they're kind of on their own agenda of, you know, preserve. I mean, they're the Criterion. They're preserving the past, because it's like all those licenses that's their goal,
right?
And so to play in today's market is you have to have a deep checkbook, and you have to have a subscription service that feeds the machine, because home video is not what's driving the revenue from all these properties.
Well, no, and you need to be on these production committees. You need to be producing things yourself.
Companies. Yeah. And so with production companies, hopefully there's too much content out right now.
Yeah, well, we just saw a 20% reduction. Like this spring, there's 20% fewer shows than there were from any, you know, given season last spring. From spring last season, it's 20% reduction, which feels like a breath of fresh air. Like you could breathe for a little bit. It's kind of nice.
Yeah.
Which had to happen at some point.
It's just right now, it just seems like anime at it. This is like the most, I just see is this is the most disposable anime is as a medium.
Yeah, of course. Well, yeah. I mean, look, season after season goes by and there's 20 shows that no one remembers.
People forget all these shows, and there's probably some great shows that are out there that people just don't remember.
Yeah, the cream rises to the top. It's still the same percentage of good to bad. It's not necessarily good to bad. It's good to mediocre. It's good to content. Some of it's just content, and it's not memorable. It's because there's so much shit being pumped out. You know, so the mediocre stuff, people forget it really fast. And even though it's a 20% reduction, it's still generally the same ratio of good to mediocre, of good to nothing. Mm-hmm. And like the churn is pretty absurd. Like looking at back at these notes and like taking this macro view, it's astonishing that y'all put Fruits Basket out in 2004 and then 2003. 3 years later, you're selling hats. And they're huge from this three-year-old anime. Like, now it would be like, oh, Fruits Basket, I remember that from a couple of years ago. Why are you trying to sell merchandise for that now? It's 2 years later. Everything moves so quick.
Yeah.
So things are very different.
It is. I just, you know, and then kind of like, how do you do stuff with licensing? You know, you back then you had multiple revenue streams with licensing, home video, streaming, broadcast, online streaming, advertising, VOD, and then you had some international sales, and then you also sold to the armed forces. You had multiple streams, and some of those streams are gone. And so really, you're kind of relying, and then I have no idea how much shows are right now, I mean, and how they're structured, just been out of it, but, you know, the business model is different.
Yeah, definitely. Things have definitely changed a lot. Do you think it's only up from here? Like, it's going to be an interesting couple of years. I think it's kind of impossible to predict. It's very tough to predict.
I think that it's going to be stable for several years.
Yeah.
Yeah, because like, it's, if people want a really good book to read, this is called The Master Switch, where it happens once you have an industry that grows and more people get into industry, Then it normalizes. It gets bought by the big companies, and then becomes the norm. It's The Master Switch by Tim Wu, and that's what happened to anime. It's you had this thing going with anime with, you know, VHS and then DVD, and then you know, you had the fan subs, and then the digi subs, and then you had the Crunchyroll that kind of disrupted everything. Then that kind of ushered off into the normalizing simulcasts, and then having stuff day in to date is like the normal stuff. And then the industry kind of rose and fell, and then got swallowed up. It's the natural evolution of business. And I see AT&T just sticking with it. It's just going to be an umbrella of, like, this is what our anime is. Is it going to be anime and cartoons? It's probably, they're so divergent that you know, it's like VRV is going to be its thing. Crunchyroll is going to be its thing. They just have to, you know, their entire goal is to get what level certain content they need to drive their ROI for investors and show growth, because they just have to show growth every year. And if something happens, and if they don't show growth, then they might not get the funding, and then it might go away. So you're always going to be chased by revenue. I mean, that's what's going to happen to Funimation. It's a little different there, I think, because, you know, it's a Japanese company, the American subsidiary, but it's the same thing. But then also you have so many production companies in Japan that there's not a dominant. And, you know, you have these umbrella companies like Crunchyroll, Funimation that just get licenses that can handle it. They have the structure, they have the machine. They have the best machine that can kind of put this stuff worldwide. And so they're kind of built for the long term. So I don't see this going away for quite a while.
Let's see. Let's get to these Twitter questions. Steph asks, there were rumors that Funimation attempted to acquire Sailor Moon. Is there truth to that rumor? And if so, do you have any stories about that?
We pitched it. We wanted it. It just didn't arrive at us. Because part of when you think about licensing stuff is rights of first refusal, mm-hmm. or publishing agreements, publishing relationships. Sometimes it's all about relationships, what you have. And so, we pitched on it. We just didn't get it. It's like, you know, we pitched to try to get Robotech and Macross to kind of put that out and release it. We didn't get that either. It's, you know, it's just kind of all these things that are holy grails.
Yeah, it's not always just money.
It's not money. It's just not money. It's like, you know, those Fruits Basket cranes that we had people folding for another season of Fruits Basket. Well, turn to find out from acquisitions is the mangaka didn't really like that show. So they weren't gonna make it again. Lo and behold, a couple years, you know, a decade, well, 15 years later, you got a great show based on the manga.
Yeah, with the mangaka's name as the first mangaka production credit.
Yeah, because it's so popular. Like, haha, I can now control what this looks like. Yeah, and kudos for her.
Yeah, it's great, but it's a much better adaptation already. Wow. It's only two episodes in. Okay. Land of Obscusion asks, you always used to tell fans to license it yourself when prompted with questions regarding why certain things do or don't get licensed. Given all the changes in the industry in the last couple of years, do you still believe in that mantra?
I don't remember to license it yourself, but part of it is it's that there are shows that just don't sell. I mean, people gave me crap for being honest if a show didn't sell, because I hated when people ask a question at a panel and said, I can either conform to it or deny, or, oh, we'll get back to you on it.
Yeah, no
I'd
answer.
I'd just rather be direct and saying, no, don't hold out hope for it, because it's not going to happen. And then it was just trying to be curt so people won't be hanging on a thread, because, you know, there's entire magazines and websites based on hearsay that you wait forever on something. And the license it yourself, I mean, that's kind of what Discotech did.
Yeah. Well, you know, it used to be...
There's a model for it.
I used to think, like, well, why don't they just say at the beginning of the Q&A session, don't ask us whether or not we've licensed something. If we have announcements, we've already made them. We will not be announcing anything at the question, so don't ask us whether or not we have something. if we haven't already announced it. And then people started doing that, and people would get up there and ask those questions anyway. So they're like, I know you said that you weren't going to announce anything, but are you interested in licensing? You know, you know better than I do. So at some point you probably said something along the lines of, well, start your own label and license that yourself. And then,
it wasn't,
you weren't blowing them off, but
it was more of, at that time it was possible to do that. Now it's kind of like, if you try to license something, you really can only get home video, where if you're trying to get streaming, then, you can't get big shows. You can try to get small shows. But then sometimes if you're just a one person company now, it's hard to get a hold of people.
Yeah.
You got to know a person to get in the door.
Yeah. All right. Our friend Bamboo asks, what do you miss most of all about those backbreaking weekends of back-to-back conventions?
What do I miss about that? I kind of miss the lunches and the hangouts kind of like the after hours or just hanging. Cause a good memory would be, Kevin Lillard, who did a fan's view, did the cosplay website, where it was a Katsucon, and he just, in between all his pictures, would just, we said, hey, hang out here. And he just hung out and got to know more, kind of like the Otakon, where, one of my first Otakons, where I hung out with Chris and Bamboo at 8N, got to know them. It's just that one time that I think like Charlene and myself crashed an 8N con panel and started getting involved in it. And,
yeah, I was there for that.
That was fun. And then though that was neat. Those little moments are what I had. And then it was just great just to, I lived in a small town in Texas, is just getting out in the world, traveling, looking at all the stuff. One thing I should have had my current me telling the past me was, use your vacation days. Take that Monday as a day off. Don't leave the next day because you have to have work. Work can always be there. Just take a day and just relax.
Yeah.
So, you'll be in Boston. I'm like, oh, great. Hey, it's Boston. You only went to the hotel. You didn't go to Boston.
Yeah. Yep. I know that feeling.
So that's what I did. And later was, take an extra day off and go to, and hang out in Pike Place whenever I went to SackerCon.
She also asks, how's the dry rub business?
It was doing good. It's doing good. It's there.
It's there. All right.
Part of the things when I said I was leaving, I was going to try and do the dry rub business, just family. Right. And I just, I did more contract stuff. I still do contract stuff right now. It's just the dry rub's there.
Right.
It didn't kind of like turn out where I want it to be, where it would be like my sole job paying the bills.
Right. Right. That's how it goes sometimes.
Plug TexasBrothersBarbecue.com if you want dry rub. The story of what dry rub is. It's barbecue dry rub. You put it on meat. That's kind of like with ribs, barbecue dry rub sauce. My dad and my uncle were one of the original barbecue teams where, all these barbecue competitions you see on TV.
Mm-hmm.
They did that in the 80s. They were one of the original teams that kind of did this stuff. Mm. So.
All right. Okay. So you also run a little site, a little blog where you post retro anime magazine content. And our friend Jeff Tebbets wants to know, if you're able to cover any depth to that, what sparked your interest in doing that in the first place? Aside from sort of cataloging the years of your career, I guess.
Yeah. Well, the history of that was whenever we moved offices from our building in Nutrition Hills to where Funimation is today in Grapevine, which is a 50,000 square foot warehouse.
Mm.
We had this one room in the old offices that was PR with all the different magazines and everything. So Jackie, our PR manager, was, you know, cleaning this out. And then there was a lot of stuff that were going to be thrown away. I'm like, wait a minute. And so it's like, I want to keep one of everything. And so that's how I started to get just my Animericas and Anime Insiders. My sister had some Animericas back in the 90s. And then whenever I go to conventions, I keep collateral. I keep so much stuff. I keep like promo items that were handed out at conventions. I still have like 7 packs of the Pioneer playing cards that one year.
Oh, yeah.
Remember those?
Yes, I do.
You know, it's just like, it's like, oh, and I had all this stuff and I'm like going, I wonder. And then one day on eBay, I just, cause like going, how far back does Animerica go? And then it was like Animerica Volume 0. I'm like, what is this?
Mm-hmm.
$5. And I'm like, oh, I would like Volume 1 of 1 Animerica. Bought that. And then it was like my old baseball cards and comic book collecting, you know, you got to be a completist. And sure. So I was just doing that. And I'm like, that'd be great to scan. So I scan some on a blog post that on my own website and posted some on Twitter. And then kind of everybody would say, oh man, you know, DVDs, you know, VHS, you know, the subtitle cost $10 more than the dub. No, it didn't. Yes, it did. I'm like, well, I've got the ad for it. I can just squash that. And so I, you know, scanned it and said, nope, here it is. Shut up. And then, you know, did that. And so then I said, well, let me do a time bomb. So that's why Animate installed a time bomb. It was like, you know, just, it was a time bomb for me to look through this stuff. And so I just started scanning. And then I went from like 1992 to I think I'm January or February of 2000 for Animerica. But then then I found from my comic shop online, Mile High Comics, all these other comic book places, they had magazines for sale. And so, and eBay, it's like, you know, the Anime Expo reference guides,
mm-hmm.
way back whenever they would watch the show. And then you would have a book where it was like the translations where you would watch it before the fan subs.
Yeah, I have some of those. They have giant Robo on the cover.
Yeah, I have like 91, 92, 93, 95, 97. And then Toshi Yoshida, who now was at Bandai, was at Viz, then Bandai, now at the Pokemon Company. You know, he's like, have you heard of Animag? Do you have any Animags? I'm like, what is Animag? I had no idea what Animag was.
Mm-hmm.
It was another magazine. It was pre-Animerica. Part of the people from Animerica were from there.
Right.
So I got Animerica, and then I got into Anime UK, Anime FX. I have complete runs of those. Then I went and said, well, what are the other ones? And I just went crazy. I finished my run of all the Anime Invasion, Anime Insider. I have 4 runs of Animerica, Animeco, Animanius. I've got some Anime. I'm looking at my spreadsheet right now. Animerica Extras. I've got several of the ICV2, the trade magazines, mm-hmm. TV Pop. I've got like issue 1 of the Beckett Dragon Ball Z collector.
Well, yeah. Doesn't that have...
Yeah, and then Manga Max, Manga Mania, Manga Heroes, Jam. I have the whenever there was a monster magazine called Markolite, I have those. I try to get issues of Neo, but I can't get a whole lot of old ones. Mecha Press, you know, lots of Protoculture Addicts when Raijin was out. And then, you know, some Shonen Jumps, and then old school stuff like VMAX.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I collected a lot of those, and then I said, I'm going to scan these and all that. Then, you know, Funimation work got busy, work got crazy. I, whenever I was deciding that, you know, my time at Funimation is, you know, coming to an end. That was also the same time when I was dating, got married, and now I have a kid.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'd love to post more, but my time right now is kind of tied up to other stuff. I mean, I do have plans on kind of trying to do 2 issues a month, but, and then I have so many videos and so much pictures of the bust, the bubble and the bust,
mm-hmm.
that I think I'm the only one that can show that perspective.
Well, in terms of archival, yeah, of course. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause I have all the pictures and I have all the video. I have a walkthrough like every year from 2003 to 2007. I walked through San Diego Comic-Con and took a video of it.
Wow. Now that would be really fascinating.
Same thing. It was like, cause like, it was, the 2003 AX where they had the gigantic Last Exile banners.
Mm-hmm.
It was the Shonen Jump huge monster banners. Yep. I remember that time where every company had banners. Banners were the thing.
Yep.
And it was stupid. It was so stupid those times. And I have chronicles of all that, all the stupidity, all the money that was spent.
Yeah, well, you know what? I'm looking forward to seeing all of that. I really want to see those videos.
The problem is, see, that's one thing about all the panel questions. Like, are you going to do this? When is this going to be released? I'm like, going, I don't really want to say all this stuff, because if I say all the stuff that I have, I'm like, oh, crap, I want to see that.
And yeah.
Like, a lot of time effort. So,
all right.
Yeah, I'm like, oh, maybe I should do a Patreon. No, no one's going to pay for it. It's just, it's just one of those things that it's like, I've done this as a labor of love. It's like, whenever I get to it, I'll get to it.
From Todd Dubois, he wants to know if you have any insight on the controversy over the 30th anniversary Dragon Ball Blu-ray box that Funimation is putting out. And he wants to know how much input, influence, and control Toei has over these releases.
Well, they're the licensor. I mean, just every contract's written differently of what the licensee, what a company like Funimation can do. And then you always ask for approvals to do things based on materials you have, materials request, what you can get.
Mm-hmm.
And then every year you have, revenue that you have to hit, and you kind of gauge of what things can make, and it's just decisions. It's it's like 4:3, 16x9. At the end of the day, I fought for 4:3 back in the day, and just the market based on numbers just was one thing sold better than the other, and that was it. So I'm glad they have the 4:3s, that they're going to do 4:3s. It's just that I don't know what materials they have. I'm kind of so far out of it that I'm glad 4:3 is being released. And, way back when we were trying to do a Kickstarter for Dragon Box, but that was way back when Kickstarter was still around. But then it was kind of like, there was trepidation in doing that. And I was trying to do a proof point, but, just old history, just glad it's going to be out. It's just, it's out of my hands.
Yeah. Well, I personally, like, the idea of doing a Kickstarter for Dragon Ball Z is sort of insulting on its face. Like, that sucks.
Yeah.
You don't need us to pay to produce something that, you know, like, come on. That's like Marvel Comics needs a Kickstarter. Come on.
Yeah, but the thing is, it's like, because when you think about that, it's these Dragon Boxes, they were not going to be at Best Buy. They were not going to be online. This was going to be kind of like just a limited thing, because no retailer would take them, because the orange bricks were the things that sold.
Right.
And so you've got to think of it as like, this is like a Dragon Ball Z Criterion thing, right, that it's going to be for a limited thing. I just think that right now there are some things that people want, but they don't want to pay that much. They just want the discs.
Right.
You need to have two versions where it's like, well, here's the ultra nice fancy stuff. And if you just want the discs, here's the discs. That's the only thing I would change is like, you know, some people are like, I don't want to pay that much. I just want the discs. Just give me the discs.
Exactly. He also asks, is there still a future for physical media?
Yes, yeah. Of course.
Yes.
It's just like look at the comic books. And then if you look at ICV2, you look at, you know, all the other, you know, digital is just a portion of comic book sales. Are comic book sales crap? Yeah, they're crap from where they were, but they've kind of like stabilized. And you got trades. It's physical. Why do you think Flight of the Conchords and all these other bands, like I got Flight of the Conchords live album. I went on the Amazon getting the CD. There was a cassette release. A fucking cassette release.
Wow.
Like people are doing cassettes now. Because what's happening now, I'm sorry, I curse, but it was just like it's ridiculous. Fine. Because it's ephemera. Mm-hmm. They want physical ephemera. You've got a generation now that is like it's online. I listen to it, and it's having something physical is what they want. It's like there are a lot of albums that never get listened to. It's just they buy it because of the artwork.
Yeah,
I mean with anime, it's always this physical media. Why did anime get really popular? Well, they were watching the fan subs. And then part of the marketing is kind of like whenever you marketed the stuff in like the 2000s, marketing was a little bit of the reason why people bought it. But the majority of the reason people bought it was they kind of watched the full series on the fan subs or like the tapes because people kick the tires and they buy it. And then people were getting so tired of just buying volume one and then just they wanted to see, well, that was crap. They wanted to see the full series before they bought it. Mm-hmm. And so that's what streaming is right now. It's just that not a whole lot of stuff gets released on physical. And that's the perception is, oh, well, less stuff is being physical. Physical's dying. Well, no, it's still the same thing where, as you said, cream rises to the top. And physical is just not dead. I mean, books are still around. You know, CDs are still around. Music's around. Physical media is still around because, you know, everybody says like, oh, it's not streaming here. Oh, license ran out. Buy it. If you like something, buy it. That was the one thing when people complained about shows. And then I would kind of like, we'd get tired. I'm like going, you need to buy the first 2 or 3 weeks when something's out. That's your vote. If you wait until 6 months later or a year to buy it, your vote's gone because if you like a certain type of genre, if you like certain something, vote with your pocketbook, and that's what companies will buy because the release date is the most crucial time when something's out.
Right.
I get off on tangents.
It's okay. Okay. Let's see here. John Ronald asks, are simuldubs sustainable long term, or will Funimation need to become even more? Do you think Funimation will need to become more choosy about the titles they pick for simuldubs?
I think simuldubs was a brilliant, risky move. I remember whenever it was brought up in a planning session, and I'm like, wow, that is a logistical. I mean, just the amount of like planning you have to do that, and it worked. Is it expensive? Yeah, but you've got something that people have always wanted. Mm-hmm. Now. Everybody, they don't want to wait. You know, people got used to waiting 18 to 12 months for a DVD release. Then volumes went away and there was 13 episodes. I had to wait a little longer. And, you know, this now is like you get your dub soon. It's brilliant. I mean, the cost is you have to have enough subscribers to kind of warrant the cost of doing that within the product. And you have to be choosy on which titles warrant the dub. So, I mean, how long has it been going on? And they still haven't stopped it, and it looks like it's still working. You've got a quality product out. I don't think I see no reason of stopping it, because you're getting the material so far in advance. Because if you're on the committee, you can get stuff early. Mm-hmm. You can ask for stuff. I mean, it's probably gotten a little better. And once you kind of do it for a couple seasons, you kind of figure out ways to kind of speed up the process and make it easier on yourself. So,
right.
I love that all these voice actors are getting more work, and there's more voice actors, and there's more variety of talent.
He also asks, does Funimation measure the relative success of a simuldub? I mean, yeah, right?
I don't know. I wasn't there when simuldubs were around.
Oh, right. That's sort of after you. Yeah. All right. Anyway, so let's move on then. Custom Zaku asks, are licensed rescues financially worth it? Does it depend on the rescued property having new material coming out? Let's say, were licensed rescues financially worth it?
Well, the licensed rescues, we had data scans, so we kind of see what it was.
Right, you just pick the stuff that's already
set release that consistently sold 100 units a month, and then kind of was not out in the market. You can kind of see it and see if people like it. And really, it's based on the amount you license it for.
Mm-hmm.
And you know that amount, and then you say, okay, well, what are my costs to put out the DVD with production wise, and then your cost of goods to produce it, and then you know, do I need to put marketing dollars towards it? That's an expense, and then you kind of just run the numbers and like 10% profit, 20% profit, 30% profit. Are we going to get a profit? Like how many months or years until we break even, and then we you know. Pass the advance, and then we pay a royalty. And so majority of them they were very profitable. I mean, there are some like on the saves that putting it in the save made properties profitable because people actually were buying them.
Hmm.
So save actually made a lot of titles profitable.
Nice. Phoenix Hawks asks, has there ever been a release that was expected to be a flop and just exploded in the Western market so much that multiple printings were required? Generally, you were better at predicting than that.
So if something was expected to be a flop, why would we buy it?
I mean, I think you could probably go the other direction. Something was expected to be huge and didn't quite hit those numbers that you thought.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I would imagine that happened with, like, famously that happened with, like, Haruhi Suzumiya, right?
Yeah, because with Genion, you saw everybody talking about it and all this, because that is a little bit to do with the comedy genre, that people love the comedy genres, but on a home video, it's the most hit and miss.
Oh, yeah?
Some do super well, like First Pass at Oran, super well.
Now, those are both, like, dramedies. To an extent,
yeah,
you know, and they also come from popular comics, like
yeah, Azumanga Daioh was super popular as well.
I would hesitate to compare that to something like Kodocha.
Oh, well, Kodocha flop.
Yeah, it's a tough sell, that one.
It was a tough sell.
Let's see, why was Funimation so adverse to doing sub-only releases for shows?
Because we were a dubbing company primarily.
Oh man, this guy managed to work into Tommy Galaxy. I'm happy about that. Okay. Every time you're on the show, it's got to come up.
Tatami was just this weird anomaly at the time that just kind of fell through the cracks.
I'm surprised it has not been put out again, because Yuasa's exploded since then.
Yeah.
So yeah. Anyway,
it's just kind of like that was a show that was ahead of its time, that didn't really get the recognition.
Wazaki asks, did Funimation during your time there, did Funimation have a say in how the video materials looked on the final product? Yeah, of course you did. In terms of video quality, how were you dealing with the stuff you got from Japan, I guess?
Well, that's more of a production question instead of a marketing question.
Sure.
But I mean, you had a QC development, you had a QC department that was created because at the beginning, like for Kitty Gray and at the very beginning of Full Metal, not only the brand manager, but I was also one getting the materials from Japan.
Yeah.
But I would get the materials, but then it would be production that I would look through them. They'd always, you would always get like a, this list of materials, and then you would have someone in production that would went through them all. And if there was something that was not right, then you would go back and get new materials from the licensor. And that's some of the reasons why some things, their release dates got changed, because some materials weren't right. You had to wait for materials. And then, I mean, there was a full QC department that once, a, you know, the, you know, once the dub was done and once you got the disc back, the QC would go through all the discs and, you know, go through every menu button, go through all the stuff. I mean, when you look at, you know, the error rates of Funimation, all the other companies, Funimation had one of the lowest error rates. It's just that sometimes it was on a big title.
Right. Okay. All right. Those are the questions. That wraps us up.
I could go on for like 2 more hours.
Well, unfortunately, I'm all out of questions, but that was a fascinating journey.
I'm almost out of coffee.
That was a fascinating journey through the bubble years and your time at Funimation. Thank you so much for coming on and sharing that, man.
All right, I got more stories, so maybe another time.
Yeah, definitely. We'll absolutely have you back. Just so people, if they do want some of that barbecue sauce, it's TexasBrothersBarbecue.com.
Here, let me go to the. It's TexasBrothersBBQ.com.
Okay, TexasBrothersBBQ.com. There you go. Head on over there, get some of Lance's sauce and rubs and all that stuff.
We'll include a link in the notes so I can get some page rank on that.
All right. All right. Thanks again, man.
All right. Take care.
Okay, that's our show. Big thanks to Lance for stopping by. The theme song is Bucharest. It's by the band The New Division. You can check them out at newdivisionmusic.com. Don't forget, subscribe to us on iTunes, Google Play Music, Stitcher Radio, all that stuff. Leave us comments. You know, it helps us out. Thanks a lot, guys. We'll see you all next week.